A reading will be taken from the book of Luke, chapter 7. And this is a story of the faith of the centurion. I'll start reading from verse 1. When Jesus had finished saying all this to the people, he had been, of course, giving his Sermon on the Mount, or Sermon on the Plain, as it's referred to in Luke, when he'd finished speaking to the people. He entered Capernaum. There, a centurion's servant, whom his master valued highly, was ill and about to die. The centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal his servant. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him. "This man deserves to have you do this, because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue." So Jesus went with them. He was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to say to him, "Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him, and turned to the crowd following him. He said, "I tell you, I have not found such great faith, even in Israel." Then the men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well. Let's just pray together before we listen to what God has to say. Prayer is an important thing. And here we see prayer in some sort of way in this passage. Someone asking Jesus for something, a form of prayer. And we'll look at it a bit closer now. I don't know whether any of you remember the TV programme Talking Telephone Numbers. No, it doesn't surprise me, because it was particularly bad, and it was only on telly for, a few months, many years ago. Well, not, hundreds, but many years ago. But the reason I mention it is because when I first went to London, I was fortunate, I don't know whether that's the word, enough to be invited by my friend to go and see the very first Talking Telephone Numbers performed live. I was very excited. I wasn't excited because I particularly thought the show would be good. It was basically a quiz show. A quiz show which happened over the first 20 minutes that would reveal a telephone number. If the telephone number was then your telephone number, you could ring in to win a prize if you answered some questions, basically. But the reason I was excited was because the people presenting the show were Philip Schofield and Emma Forbes. And I was brought up in the going live era of television on a Saturday morning with Philip Schofield and Emma Forbes. And I used to love it. And I used to think, oh, what great banter they have. Do you think they're going out? Oh, is there a relationship there? Oh, I could be their friends. Oh, they're so exciting. And I used to love to watch it every Saturday. Philip Schofield was just amazing. And Emma Forbes, well, she added a bit of fun to it with him, and it was wonderful. So I turned up at this Talking Telephone Number show, and I thought, well, what will Philip Schofield be like in real life? Because I've seen him on going live, and I think he's wonderful. What will he be like when the cameras stop rolling? I'm sure he'll have a bit of banter with us all, and it'll be fun, and it'll be good. So there we were. First 25 minutes of the show were pre-recorded, so that was a bit dull for a start. We sat there watching a pre-recorded show. But the last 5 minutes were live. Someone was going to win thousands of pounds for the first time, and Philip and Emma were hosting. So we go live, countdown, cameras start rolling, lights come on, very exciting. Unfortunately, complete disaster. Person phones in, tries to answer questions, can't answer questions. Another person phones in with the same number, tries to answer questions, can't answer questions. First show ever of this new programme. No one wins the prize. Bit of a letdown, bit of a disaster in broadcasting terms. So then the credits roll and the cameras are switched off. And I think now is the moment when Philip will throw out a couple of jokes and we'll all be in fits of laughter. Well, no. Philip Schofield, to our surprise and shock, when the cameras stop rolling, turns to us all, and in no uncertain terms, with a few expletives thrown in, tells us how bad the show was, and then storms off. Well, we were a little disappointed, but we were thinking, no, Philip's going to come back. It was all part of the act. Never appears. Lights go on. Out you go, everyone. Bye. Thanks for coming. Well, I have to say, I was a little upset. Because the Philip Schofield I knew wasn't like that. But it seems he was different in real life. And you know, in this passage we've just read, I imagine a similar scene. Stay with me. You see, because Jesus had just delivered the Sermon on the Mount. You know, he just delivered this amazing talk. He just set out his stall of how things were going to be. He just painted a picture of the new way of God. He'd just given one of the most amazing preaches ever. He just turned the world upside down for everyone listening. And he'd done it in front of a huge number of people. The world would relive this speech right up until today. We're still talking about it. It was, if you like, a lights, camera, action moment. You know, this is it. This is the new way. Look at me. I'm presenting it. And then it's as if the cameras stop running. And we enter our passage today. You know, Jesus leaves the crowds and he walks away. And the moment arrives when we will see if the Jesus of the speech is the real deal. The moment arrives when we will see if Jesus can live out this image that he has just created in front of everyone. It is, if you like, the Philip Schofield moment. And it faces Jesus immediately as he leaves the plane that he's been talking on. Because as Jesus comes down and enters Capernaum, he is faced with a request for healing. A request for healing from a centurion about his servant. Now, you know, this is not unusual. You know, it's not an unusual thing. Jesus has already, in the book of Luke, cast out an evil spirit. He's already healed fevers and sickness. He's already cured a man of leprosy. He's already dramatically healed a paralytic and forgiven his sins. It's not unusual for Jesus to have a request for healing. However, what is unusual is who this request comes from. Because as Jesus finishes speaking, as he leaves the plane and enters Capernaum, as the lights go cold and the cameras are packed away, he's met by some elders of the Jews, some Jewish community leaders, if you like, who come to speak to him on behalf of a centurion whose servant is sick and about to die. As Jesus enters Capernaum, you see, he is faced with a request from a centurion, a Roman centurion, a middle-ranking military officer, a person under Herod's rule, a Gentile, someone deployed to Capernaum to hold a high position in society with arguably much money. So when Jesus enters Capernaum, the request he faces comes from a rich, high society Gentile, if you like. Now you might say, well, what's wrong with that? Anyone can ask for healing from Jesus. I mean, what's wrong with a rich, high society Gentile asking for healing? Jesus accepts anyone. Well, you know, I guess there's nothing wrong with it today. This is what we would say. But back in the time of Jesus, there would have been all sorts of things wrong. Because you see, for starters, Jesus was a Jew. And back in the day, well, centurions generally looked down on Jews. And, well, Jews generally hated centurions. Because you see, centurions were sent to look after the Jews, to care for them, to keep control of them. Centurions were near the top of the tree. Jews were near the bottom. Centurions were outsiders in Jewish culture. Jews were the culture. Centurions were Gentiles. Jews were Jews. Jews and Gentiles didn't get on. So when the centurion finds he has a problem that he cannot solve, he sends word to Jesus. When the high society Gentile finds he's in trouble, he calls to Jesus. Well, when this happens, there's something very wrong, isn't there? Because Jesus is a Jew. And not only that, he travels around the area mixing with the poor. He's lonely in society. He has little or no money. So in effect, here we have a high society Gentile calling for help from a low society Jew. We have one who has it all reaching out to one who seems to have nothing. We have an outsider who is reaching into the culture. We have a Gentile who is known to be far from God calling out to a Jew. Here we have one who normally looks down on society, calling for help from one who normally would hate him. On the face of it, this situation is completely mad. There's no other way to describe it. It's unheard of in Jesus' time. This would never happen. On the face of it, it's crazy. There's no way that this would happen in the society in which Jesus lived. Just to make it a little bit clearer to you, anyone seen Shrek? Princess Fiona, Shrek. You look at them before she reveals who she is. They fancy each other. It's crazy. Why would he fancy her and she fancy him? On the face of it, it's mad. It would never happen. It's crazy. On the face of it, it's totally wrong. And that's exactly what the centurion situation was like. So when I look at this passage, I find myself, as with most passages in the Bible, asking the question, why? Why did the centurion even consider approaching Jesus? Why, when he needed help, did he think, oh, I know, I'll ask a Jewish man? You know, and why did Jesus, knowing who was asking, agree to go and help him? And why, when the centurion had approached Jesus and Jesus had agreed to go and help, which was strange in itself, did the centurion then send his friends to say, oh, don't come after all? Why, when on the face of it the situation seems so wrong, did the centurion and Jesus even bother to try in the first place? Well, I guess just like Shrek and Fiona, even though on the face of it all seemed wrong, at the heart of the situation, everything was exactly right. We see it when the Jewish leaders come to Jesus and say, this man deserves to have you do this because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue. They say, this man who is supposed to hate us actually likes us. This man who is not one of us actually cares for us. This man deserves your help. And then the centurion, speaking through his friend, says, I do not deserve you to have you come under my roof. I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. He says, I am socially above you, but I realize that in reality you are greater than me. I don't deserve for you to be present, and I don't deserve to meet you. In comparison to you, I am nothing. You see, although society and culture and religion were against the centurion, although on the face of it all looked wrong, his heart and his character and his humility stood out for everyone to see. But perhaps the most amazing thing, and what made this situation between Jesus and the centurion work in the first place, was what he said next. Because he says to Jesus, but say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes. And this one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. He says to Jesus, say the word, because I am a man under authority just like you. I am a man under authority just like you. Or if you like, the centurion says, I know you have power and authority. I know it has been given to you. I know you can do this. I know who you are. Whether he realized it or not, the centurion had grasped what very few people had at this point, that Jesus could do what he chose because Jesus was living in God's authority. The centurion was actually declaring that Jesus was God here on earth. He was putting his faith in Jesus. The high society Gentile was bowing the knee to the low society Jew. Because in some way, he had realized that social standing, religious knowledge, and cultural difference came a very distant second in the light of God. And he was willing to put it all on the line, because in the light of Jesus, he realized everything had changed. And now, he was playing by new rules. I don't know whether any of you have seen the Lord of the Rings saga on film, anyone? Yes, quite long, especially if you have the extended version, which we thought was a good idea first time round. Anyone seen the second film, The Two Towers? A few, yes. Well, I have to say, out of all of them, that is my favourite. For a start, it doesn't seem to go on as long as the third one. It goes on and on and on. But it's also got a great battle scene. And me being one for a bit of battle, bit of blood and gore, maybe I shouldn't really be saying that, I really enjoy it. Because you see, basically, the story, just a quick recap on the second one, is that Saruman, evil, bad, is creating his army of orcs to defeat everyone on Middle-earth. And you see, the human beings... And they're having a laugh turn here. Have I said something wrong? Is the story wrong? The human beings, and the elves and all the other people have decided the only way they can survive this onslaught of evil from Saruman is to go to their old favourite, Helm's Deep, which is basically a castle built into the mountain. So you only have to defend it on one side. Fairly secure. There's a bit of an argument, should we go, should we not? But anyway, they all go. Women, children, everyone. Women and children go deep into the mountain to hide and weep and rock their children. And it's all dramatic. And the men gather round the wall to protect Helm's Deep. Meanwhile, Saruman is creating his army. And Gandalf, our great leader, has departed, saying, look for me on the third day. By then, off he goes. So there we are. All the good people standing around ready to protect the walls. And the army starts to march towards them. And you're thinking, oh, yeah, I think this could be done. I think this is possible. Protecting it for 3 days, not bad. Then you see the army of orcs. Pure evil. Blunt swords. How unfair is that? Horrible faces, thousands and millions of them, and you think, I'm not sure, maybe it's going to be a bit harder than we thought. But the battle begins, and there are our intrepid heroes defending the wall with guts and honour, and evil is sweeping towards it. And you're thinking, they can do it, and they're cutting heads off. And we won't go into details, and then the battle is roaring away. They're being attacked by spears and arrows and people running towards them, but they're defending it. And you're on the edge of your seat thinking, they can do it. They've only got 2 more days to defend. And then in the middle of the battle, one of the orcs runs towards the wall with a bomb. And it explodes, ripping a hole in the wall. At which point I was in the cinema going, no! And the orcs pour through, and our trepid explorers, no, heroes, back off. And the women and children are weeping and wailing and crying. Anyway, you're thinking there's no way. They're going to die. All of them are going to die. But then the third day arrives, and they're in dire straits. Still the wailing, still the death, still the evil is coming towards them. And suddenly they remember Gandalf saying, look for me on the third day. And so our little group of intrepid heroes decide they're going to ride out into the midst of evil, into the midst of the orcs and the battle. And so they open the gates and they ride out. And as they ride out, throwing people aside into the midst of the darkness, suddenly Gandalf appears over the hill, as brilliant light as you imagine. And the light sweeps across the battlefield, and the orcs are thrown apart, those who aren't run away. And the scene completely changes from one of devastation and death and pain and almost certain defeat to one of victory and peace and kind of mopping up after the disaster. But when Gandalf arrives, the greater power, everything changes. In the light of this power, everything is different. And you know, similarly, in the light of Jesus in this passage, everything changed. In the light of him, all was new. A Gentile approached a Jew. The rich asked help from the poor. Those far away from God were invited into the kingdom of God. Everything changed when Jesus arrived. But you know, we know this, don't we? It's not new. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. We talked about it last week, for instance, and we've talked about it before. We know that Jesus makes things different when he's around. We know it. But we don't always manage to live it, do we? You know, in our lives, as in our society, social standing is still very important. In our lives, as well as in our churches, religious knowledge still matters. In our lives, as all around us, cultural differences are still held high. We know things should be different in Jesus. We know everything changes, but we don't often live it, do we? In society, it still matters to us what position we hold. It still matters to us what image we project. It still matters to us whether we are accepted or not accepted. What people look like, where they come from, how they act, and what they do sways us massively in how we treat them. We still struggle to value our culture and ethnicity equally. We all have a view of hierarchy in the end, don't we? We all secretly believe that our culture and our ethnicity stands a little above the rest. In the light of Jesus, this should all come a distant second. But in the light of Jesus today, I don't think it does. Do you know, in 1997, there were many events that took place. Simon and I got married. Anyway, that's bye-bye. But two events particularly took place. One of them will be remembered by many. It happened on the 31st of August at 3 a.m. It was the morning when Princess Diana died in a car crash in France. It was interesting because her funeral took place on Saturday, the 6th of September, 1997. There was a 4-mile procession to Westminster Abbey. Over 1 million people lined the route. 2.5 billion watched the funeral. 43 books of condolences were opened at Kensington Palace. And over 1 million flowers were shipped in to the country so that people could lay them in memory of her. She was 37 years old, and she was from high society standing. On the 5th of September, 1997, at 5 p.m., Mother Teresa died. Tens of thousands lined her route. She was 87 years old, and she was working among the poor, low in society. Image, status, and standing are so important. And we treat people differently depending on where we are. And we treat people differently depending on where they are. In the church as well, we aren't always that different. It still matters so much to us what people think of us in church. It still matters so much just what experience we have. It matters so much how many times we've heard from God, how close people think we are to God, how well we can articulate our faith. We struggle to be accepted, and we struggle to accept other people. In the light of Jesus, this should all be a distant second. But in the light of Jesus today, unfortunately, it isn't. And it's not that all these things shouldn't matter. It's not that we should just be a bunch of clones who are exactly the same, cast out by society in our own little church. It's not like that. It's simply that in the light of Jesus, in the light of God's power on earth, in the light of God's authority, in the light of a new way of living, everything changes. And we should therefore try and change too. We should become people who truly love across boundaries, people who truly care about others, people who are willing to put everything on the line for faith in Jesus. You see, when Jesus received the request from the centurion, he wasn't bothered that he was a Gentile. He didn't care that he lived among the high classes. He wasn't bothered that he came from a different culture. He wasn't bothered that the centurion was different, because the love of God crosses all boundaries. The grace of God is here for all people. The compassion of Jesus looks for any little opening it can find. In the light of Jesus, there is a completely new way to live. What matters in this story is that the centurion was able to step into that new way. Or to put it into the words of Jesus in this passage, he was amazed at him. And turning to the crowd following him, he said, "I tell you, I have not found such great faith even in Israel." Here was an outsider willing to take the risk of changing his life for Jesus. Do you know, the end of the story shows that Jesus is exactly who he claimed to be. He comes through the Philip Schofield moment with flying colours. He proves the faith of the centurion to be true. He shows his unequaled authority. As the passage says, then the men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well. Jesus has no intention of letting us down. What we need to work out is, in the light of Jesus, do we have the courage to put all we hold dear on the line? In the light of Jesus, can we be a people who truly say, we will cross all boundaries to walk in faith with him? Let's pray together.